Welcome to the New Books Network.
Welcome to the Language on the Move podcast, a channel on the New Books Network. My name is Bryn Quick, and I'm a PhD candidate in linguistics at Macquarie University in Sydney, Australia. My guest today is Dr. Michael Chestnut. Michael is a professor in the Department of English for International Conferences and Communication at Hanguk University of Foreign Studies in Seoul, Korea. His work includes researching second language writing, TESOL teacher development, curriculum theory, linguistic landscape research, and translingual academic publishing practices. Today, we're going to talk in general about an area of study in linguistics known as the linguistic landscape, and in particular about a 2022 paper that Michael co-authored with Nate Ming Karan and Sungwoo Kim, entitled From Garbage to COVID-19, Theorizing Multilingual Commanding Urgency in the Linguistic Landscape. Michael, welcome to the show, and thank you so much for joining us today.
I'm so happy to be here, and thank you for having me on today. And it's so exciting to get a chance to actually talk about a paper. This is such a rare opportunity. I'm just delighted to be here and share my thoughts.
Wonderful. To start us off, can you tell us a bit about yourself and how you became a linguist, as well as what led you to living and working in Korea?
Sure. Well, I'll start with the last question there. So about 20 years ago, as a young person, having graduated university and not too sure what I was going to do for a career or with the rest of my life, I decided to go abroad. I wanted to get out of Canada, where I'm from. And at the time, a lot of young people in Canada, especially new university graduates, were going off to Korea for a year to teach English, come back with a little bit of money, pay off student loans, and then carrying on with the rest of their lives. So basically, I did that, and I had no interest in Korea. I had done a little bit of teaching, and I liked it. So I thought this would also be a good opportunity just to play with teaching and get some more experience. I applied all over the world, but I applied a lot in Korea because that's where a lot of people were going. I didn't get many job offers because I wasn't particularly qualified. And then I got one offer in a small town in Korea. A few weeks later, I got an offer from Siberia and Russia, but they were too late. So off to Korea I went, and it was interesting. It was really interesting to be in a new country, be immersed in a new language, have no idea what was going on. Teaching was quite interesting and challenging, and I really enjoyed that first year. So I stayed in that same small town for a second year. After 2 years, I was starting to get more interested in teaching and wanted to become better at what I was doing. I wanted to remain in Korea and better understand the world I found myself in. So I was very lucky, and I found a position at a small university, Ulsan University in Daejeon. And what was so wonderful was they had an MA TESOL program. So I could teach there, doing all sorts of different classes, and pursue an MA in TESOL to actually learn better how to teach English. And what was really remarkable was that this particular program had a focus on critical pedagogy, teaching not just as a replication of existing knowledge, not just sort of helping you know more so you can do a job, but teaching as a means to kind of give more power to students, let them make more informed choices, help them better understand why we're learning something in particular, why we don't look at certain other issues. And so that was a really wonderful 2 years. I enjoyed it. I did a small thesis on language learner identity, and I was really interested in continuing this journey. And that program was founded, or at least developed heavily, by a professor named Kiwon Sung, and he had studied at Penn State. And so really, through him, I had an opportunity to apply to Penn State in their College of Education, doing a PhD in curriculum and instruction. And the professors there mentored him, and some of the professors he mentored had come back to Korea too. And so I was able to pursue further education through a PhD at Penn State. And I went there and took a lot of classes in the Applied Linguistics Department, really found a second home there alongside curriculum and instruction in the College of Education. And my goal was always to come back to Korea as quick as possible to do field work. And so my PhD dissertation was on foreign language teacher identity, the Americans, Canadians, and others who come to Korea and teach English. That's still a major area of research for me. And so all of that let me come to Hankook University of Foreign Studies in my department here, Department of English for International Conferences and Communication, which is essentially an English interpretation and translation department going English and Korean. Here I teach English and I do research as part of the university's responsibilities as well. And so that's my journey to being here now, where I teach a lot of different classes. Some are language classes, some are world Englishes or digital media classes, all with this language focus. And I do research on different issues as well. So that's kind of my story and who I am as a teacher and a researcher. And so again, thanks so much for having me on to talk about all this. It really is such a privilege to get a chance to talk about a paper. I'm so happy to be here.
Oh, that's excellent. I'm so glad. I'm so glad to be talking to you too. And that's really interesting to think how differently your life might have gone if Siberia had answered, you know, just a couple weeks earlier and not been late.
Oh, absolutely. You know, if it had just been slightly reversed off to northern Russia in the early 2000s.
A little colder.
Little colder, different environment. Who knows how life could have turned out then, you know?
Yeah. So let's talk a bit about your work. So quite a bit of your work has to do with something called the linguistic landscape. So not everyone listening to us right now is a linguist. So can you explain what that term linguistic landscape means and why it's something that linguists study?
Sure. And so even if you're not a linguist or don't have a particular interest even in language, you encounter the linguistic landscape all the time. The linguistic landscape is essentially all the publicly displayed language or text you see around it. So walking down the street, you see street signs, shop fronts, billboards, movie posters. All of that is the linguistic landscape, all the different text and language you see around you. And that includes graffiti, those stickers you see stuck on telephone poles or maybe on a utility panel on a back alley. It's menus posted on restaurant walls. But when people talk about the linguistic landscape, there's often a real emphasis on multilingualism, on things that have more than one language. There's actually many different researchers who look at movie posters or different types of signs, people who study marketing, for example. But people who talk about the linguistic landscape are usually talking about text with more than one language. That's where a lot of the focus, not all, but a lot of the focus is. And so one reason to study this is just the general benefit of understanding something better. These signs are important. They're an important means of communication. So it's better to have a deeper understanding of how this communication works. And, you know, over the years, I've heard some people, some linguists, say, oh, you know, this is actually not real research. This is a hobby. This is someone going on holiday, taking a bunch of photographs, enjoying themselves, coming back and kind of sharing these pictures. But I'd push back on that and say, there's actually a lot of important communication occurring through multilingual signs. An emergency exit sign in multiple languages can be very important. Looking at movie posters and how they use different scripts or different fonts to mimic other languages or play with what they're writing. That's an interesting linguistic phenomenon. So I think it's worthwhile, and society does value better understanding this communication. So that's one general reason, but there's a lot of different reasons, more specific reasons, to examine the language on signs. Some involve determining the vitality or strength of a language in a particular place. So walking down the street in a maybe French-speaking community in Canada, are there a lot of signs in French? That's a quick and rough way to determine how strong that language is in that place, although there are very serious limits to examining language that way, because often language doesn't come into signs. There can be a language spoken in a region, but for various reasons, it doesn't appear on signs. And likewise, there can be a place where a language is no longer spoken very much, but it often appears on signs. And so people examine that. People examine issues of language ideology or the assumptions we make about language, the values we give to language, and then ask, how does those values and assumptions shape the language on signs. Maybe there's different varieties of a language, but only one appears on signs. And so we can go in and look at, okay, how are these assumptions and values shaping the use of language on signs? There's studies involving English as a lingua franca, where English sort of has this role as a general and shared means of communication among people who don't speak English as a first language, where the rules of English are determined more by what is effective communication rather than a standard that comes from the United States or the UK. And so how does English work in a tourist destination where people are visiting from all over the world? People examine context like that. There's a lot of different studies out there. English is a major topic in linguistic landscape research. So some people examine how English can be a symbol of cosmopolitanism, sophistication, style, and a means of attracting consumers. People examine skinscapes, so multilingual tattoos, and everything that happens when people get a tattoo that involves different languages or multiple languages. How languages are involved in the construction of public space. There's been some great research on Israel and the use of Hebrew, Arabic, English to construct a particular place through those signs. Studies on commodification. So we can examine Little Italy or Chinatown and look at how language is deployed there, not necessarily reflecting how people speak in that place anymore, but as a means of commodifying and selling that place. There are studies on how problems are addressed, maybe littering, garbage, public intoxication, through multiple languages on signs addressing those problems. There's questions about signs that come from authorities that seem to go down to the people, top-down signs, and the languages used in those signs, and languages that come from, you know, regular people, signs posted by people about problems in their neighborhood or a lost dog, and the languages used on those signs, and maybe the differences between those top-down, bottom-up signs. There are studies on how the linguistic landscape can be used in teaching, and I've investigated this, and I've used this in a lot of my classes, that we can take pictures of signs into classrooms, into educational contexts, and use that to help people develop their language skills. But ultimately, we're looking at a lot of issues of what languages are present on signs. How are those languages being used? What shapes the presence and absence of different languages on these signs? What larger issues in society impact and are impacted by the use of language on signs? And even now, maybe how the use of languages on signs can challenge existing assumptions in society regarding language and more. And there's some really exciting developments occurring in different places in the world. There are some massive indigenous construction developments, housing developments in Canada. And I've seen some pictures of those developments where they're using the language of that community on those signs. So that's really interesting. I'd love to read more about that.
That sounds fascinating. And also, excuse me now while I go Google linguistic skinscapes. That sounds so cool. I've never heard of that as an area of study before. That's awesome.
No, it's really fascinating. It's not my area. I did a little research because I encountered one paper years ago, and then I did some more research, and there's been some interesting development in that area. So really, there are people doing all sorts of interesting research in different areas, very exciting developments. And some of it is, I think, quite important. It could contribute to creating more productive communication in different ways.
I agree. And that's a great explanation. And I think that in your explanation, you're doing a great job of pushing back against those people who would say that this is, you know, maybe just a hobby or something that a tourist would do. And you're right, it is a really important part of the world that we all live in. So on that, let's talk about your 2022 paper, From Garbage to COVID-19, Theorizing Multilingual Commanding Urgency in the Linguistic Landscape. In the paper, you develop the concept of multilingual commanding urgency. What does multilingual commanding urgency mean, and how might it appear in the linguistic landscape?
Sure. Well, why don't I take us through a little example, something that occurred to me, and then we can maybe explore it together and think about how multilingual commanding urgency kind of helps us understand what's happening around us with some of the signs we see. So we can imagine maybe we're at a ski resort in North America, and walking through this ski resort, we see lots of different signs. A big welcome sign in English, maybe a giant sign with the name of the place positioned so we can all take photographs with it, post them on Instagram, and lots of signs that are important. Rest area here, ski hills that way, maybe a sign, all in English, that says only qualified skiers should go down these particular hills. Kind of a warning and informational sign to direct people how they should go depending on their level of skill. And as we walk around this ski resort, we see something different. We see a sign that says, do not feed the wildlife. But this sign is also in Korean and Chinese. And looking around, we see that as the only sign that is in English, Korean, and Chinese. And so we might start to wonder, why is this sign and this sign alone in our scenario the only sign that is trilingual, incorporating Korean and Chinese, while all these other signs, some quite important, feature only English? And multilingual commanding urgency is our attempt to conceptualize an answer to that question. And so what we argue is that often in the world, sign makers will, rightly or wrongly, have an idea about who is likely to violate the regulation posted on a sign. There are certain language communities believed to be potential violators of these particular regulations. And there's a belief that if this regulation is posted in a language of that community, it will reduce the enforcement burden of those authorities. And when those two conditions are met, there seems to be a greater urgency or effort or impetus to make that sign multilingual. And so I would explain this imagined do not feed wildlife sign as occurring because some sign maker, some authority within this resort, for some reason believes Korean-speaking guests and Chinese-speaking guests may be more likely to violate this regulation, and that if they post this message in those languages, it will resolve the situation, reduce the enforcement burden of authorities. Now, that may be completely incorrect, but that may be the authorities' belief. And this is an imagined scenario, but it is based on something I actually saw in North America at one point. And we can see this in other places too. You can imagine walking through an airport, maybe an airport in Germany, and this one did happen to me very recently, and see all the signs, or many, many signs in German and English. Baggage claim area, gates 1 through 10, all these different signs in English and German. But then you see a door, and it's an emergency exit, and it's alarmed. If a member of the public opens the door, an alarm goes off, authorities have to rush in, people have to investigate, a lot of things occur. And that door sign has a warning, but not just in German and English, but also Arabic, Russian, and Chinese. And this I saw in an airport in Germany. And so that would be explained, I believe, likely by this multilingual commanding urgency. Authorities have identified certain communities as likely to violate this regulation. They believe that if they put the sign in those languages, it will reduce their enforcement burden. The fewer times they have to rush to that emergency door, the better for them. And this creates an urgency, an impetus to make signs multilingual. So that's multilingual commanding urgency. That's what we conceptualize as the genesis of multilingualism in many of these signs. And there's a lot of examples in literature that don't talk about multilingual commanding urgency that come from earlier studies, but that were foundational. Examples of a do not spit sign in an airport in New Zealand, that sign was only in Chinese and Korean, not in English, and actually seemed to create a bit of a furor on social media. Signs in Hong Kong, which include Tagalog prohibiting hawking, signs in Hungarian in Toronto, Canada, about a code of conduct prohibiting, requiring some behavior for young people. And so we do see across literature lots of examples of this. And so this paper and this concept of multilingual commanding urgency are an attempt to explain and discuss this sort of pretty broad phenomenon. Does that provide an explanation of this phenomenon?
That's a great answer. And it also makes me think of another space where I've seen these types of signs before here in Australia, and that's in public restrooms, public toilets, where, and I do believe I've seen papers before, and even on our research blog, the Language on the Move research blog, we've featured these stories before about how on the backs of the stalls, in at least in the women's toilets, there will be these signs about, I guess, toilet etiquette, and it will only be in certain languages. So again, to your point of these maybe potential violators of these rules being identified, rightly or wrongly, by the higher up authorities, and then that being targeted through these specific languages. And your paper looks at cases of multilingual commanding urgency in Seoul, Korea, and specifically two types of directive signs that you and your colleagues found during the height of the COVID-19 pandemic. First, COVID-19 related, quote, masks required signs in subway stations. And second, signs prohibiting illegal garbage disposal inside streets. These might sound like totally unrelated signs at first, but your paper found a fascinating connection between them. Can you tell us what you discovered about which languages were used for these different types of signs?
Sure. So I'll start by describing these two signs in detail a little bit. So the first set of COVID-19 mask required signs were posted because prior to their posting, there had been strong encouragement to wear masks on subways and in public transportation. But as the pandemic developed, there was a regulation developed that required masks to be worn by everyone in subways, in the subway station, on public transportation. And so suddenly there was this new regulation: on this day, everyone has to wear a mask. And all these signs appeared. Now, these signs were very large. They covered pillars in subway stations. You could sit at the entrance of a subway station and see a half dozen to a dozen of them just from one spot. And they were monolingual Korean, and they were large, multicolored, and everywhere. But shortly thereafter, in a matter of days, appeared much smaller signs, A4 sized about. And these signs are the same general message, not as much detail. The larger Korean language signs had details about where to buy masks. Each station had a little section, or each sign at each station had a little additional information about the nearby convenience store or nearby location where you could buy masks. These were absent in the other signs, and these other signs, much smaller, a little bit less well-produced, had the same general message in English, Chinese, and Japanese. And so they appeared after. And this was quite interesting to us. These two signs appearing together, that's one set of signs that were really important to us. The other set of signs, and we actually didn't collect these signs entirely during the pandemic. Most of these signs were actually collected earlier. Images of these signs were collected earlier. And so these are signs prohibiting the disposal of garbage, basically don't litter. And there's kind of a sophisticated system in Korea for the disposal of household garbage. A lot of apartment complexes will have a recycling system. Individuals can go buy garbage bags. Payment goes into fund the trash disposal system. And so some people litter to avoid this, or because it can be inconvenient or whatever. And so this is a major issue. A lot of people get upset by trash. You don't want trash in front of your house. And so there's a lot of district level government signs about prohibiting the use of prohibiting the disposal of garbage. And what we found was in certain districts, these signs included Arabic, Vietnamese, Chinese, English, and certain signs only had Korean, Vietnamese, and Chinese, no English. And so that was quite interesting. And what's also critical here is that Korean government signage rarely features Arabic and Vietnamese, some English, some Chinese, but very rarely Arabic and Vietnamese, and very, very rarely on district level signage. These are kind of neighborhood government level neighborhood government level signs. And so these were very unusual signs to see Vietnamese and Arabic being used in these ways. And so what happened was me and my co-authors, and my apologies for not mentioning Nate Minkaran and Sungo Kim earlier, I should, they're absolutely foundational to this whole project and our continuing work on COVID-19 signs. But we decided to collect data from our daily routines as part of, during the COVID-19 pandemic, just to better understand how signs were being used regarding COVID-19. And as we collected data and we examined it and we looked at it in different ways, we were really struck by these mask required signs and these additional small multilingual signs. And what was really striking was there was other mask signs that were encouraging mask use more generally, and often quite powerfully, using fear and sometimes cuteness to encourage mask wearing, pardon me. But they were monolingual Korean. So we were trying to understand what led to the additional signs requiring people to wear masks in English, Chinese, and Japanese. And so we were reviewing literature and we started to look deeper into the context of signage in Korea. And we found the examples in our already collected data of these garbage signs. And we really thought this might be the same phenomenon. And we looked at it more and we really started to think this is the same phenomenon in two different ways. In the COVID-19 mask required signs, we're finding English, Chinese, and Japanese as the languages to speak to the general non-Korean foreign public. And in the signs about garbage using Vietnamese and Arabic, we have the language used to speak to the Arabic and Vietnamese speaking communities in these districts. And so we found different examples that were both the result of what we believe to be the same phenomenon. And so our analysis of the COVID-19 linguistic landscape is ongoing, but we found these examples and decided to share a sort of conceptual paper that used these two examples to really look deeply at what we started calling, what we termed multilingual commanding urgency, and what we were finding being discussed in the literature. So we wanted to bring that all together in one paper, use these two different examples to really understand this phenomenon and discuss it and expand on it. And that's what came together in our paper. And so we argue that these two very different sets of signs are ultimately the product of a belief that certain language communities are likely to be violators of a certain regulation, and a belief that by sharing the sign, making the sign in a certain language, you can reach that community and lower the enforcement burden for authorities. And so that's how this paper came about.
And that's so interesting because, like we've said, we all, as just people who are walking around in the world, are going to see these signs, could potentially read these signs. But a really interesting point that you make in your paper is that exactly this, that these types of signs have the potential to be overread by passerby. And you point out that these people might not actually be able to read the languages on these signs. So maybe if there's, you know, a monolingual French speaker walking around in that context, they might not be able to read the languages, but they may know what languages they are. They might be able to say, oh, I can tell that's Arabic. Oh, I can tell that's Vietnamese. So what inferences and assumptions might these passerby who have nothing to do with, you know, the government then make about the communities that are being addressed through these very specific language choices with these directive signs?
Well, so this concept of overreading signs comes, well, we borrow it from Philip Angermeyer, who has an amazing paper looking at Roma youth from Hungary in Toronto, Canada, and the situation where some youth centers and certain places started putting up signs in Hungarian, sort of codes of behavior to try and regulate what was perceived to be kind of inappropriate behavior by these youth. And he interviewed youth and authorities there, and it's an absolutely phenomenal paper. And what he also pointed out was these signs can be wrong. They used Google Translate to create the Hungarian. So in some cases, it was really nonsensical. And so for these youth, it was somewhat, offensive, disheartening, disappointing to see not just signs about poor behavior in a language directed to them, but also poor translations, signs they don't even care enough to translate. And so we're discussing how, in general, you know, these multilingual directive signs about bad behavior can be overread potentially by anyone, sometimes even mistakenly, in a way that suggests certain communities might be responsible for this bad behavior, engaging in some inappropriate behavior or violating regulations. So if anyone's walking down the street, and maybe you can read one language, maybe the dominant language is there, and you can read a sign saying something about disposal of pet waste or smoking in an area you're not supposed to smoke, and then you see it in certain languages that are very rarely used by authorities, it's very easy to link those language-speaking communities with this inappropriate behavior, this aberrant behavior. And so that's the concern, that these signs might reinforce larger public beliefs that certain communities are engaging in so-called bad behavior, linking communities with problematic practices. And so really, this could be having a negative effect on society, especially when languages are very rarely used in more general government or authoritative signage, or even more generally, and only used in these signs linked with bad behavior. That's the really problematic element.
Yeah, it's that perpetuation of a potential stereotype that exists within a community. And like you said, especially if it does come from that more governmental district level position of power, then that might perpetuate the stereotype even further. And you mentioned earlier that these particular trash signs came from a little bit earlier, but the paper, so that was 2020 or a little bit earlier, but the paper was published in 2022. It's now 2024. Have you seen any change in these types of signs in the intervening years? Are there still these quote unquote problem communities that are being targeted through specific multilingual commanding urgency signs around Seoul?
Well, there's certainly signs like this still about. There was an absolutely fantastic paper about a district with a large Chinese community in Seoul. And that paper had amazing examples and kind of heartbreaking examples of signs only in Korean that request people to report others for bad behavior, and then signs only in Chinese saying don't engage in problematic behavior like public drunkenness and other inappropriate acts. And so certainly this still exists. Now, perhaps that paper's from a little while ago too. So some of these signs might have changed, and certainly a lot of COVID signage has been taken down. Some remains, but I suspect, these are long enduring signs, metal signs posted on walls. So I suspect many of them are still up. I've seen signs that are, 10 years old. They remain for a long time. And I think I do want to point out, I think this is a kind of global phenomenon. I think signs like this can be found in many places all over the world. So I wouldn't necessarily single out any city or particular region, but I haven't seen any major changes that way. What I have seen that's encouraging is I've started to see some emergency signage that's being made more multilingual. So we have a lot of emergency shelter signs and emergency shelters in Seoul. And a lot of the time I've seen them in English, Korean, and then sometimes Korean English, and sometimes Korean English Chinese. But I recently saw one that had Korean, and that was the largest language by far. English was the second largest. Beneath that was Vietnamese, Thai, Japanese, and Chinese. So that I would not consider multilingual commanding urgency. That's maybe a different type of language phenomenon, a different type of sign. And so there might be a move towards more multilingualism in general that would certainly potentially lessen the potential for overreading of certain directive signs. And so that would also be the policy I would advocate. There is a need for signs directing people not to dispose of trash illegally. And if you want to reach out to a community, then reach out in many ways, not just through this directive signage, but include that language on many different signs so it becomes less significant with this problematic directive. So I do see some positive developments in more general multilingualism, but I think these signs do remain, and maybe they do have a purpose. And so I hope there's some positive developments. I also, since COVID, I've also been out a lot less. So, and I have family responsibilities these days that are new. So I'm collecting less general data and I don't quite observe as much as I used to. So I hope that's a reasonable answer.
It is. And what I love too about your paper and about this type of work into the linguistic landscape is that any person walking around in their own community, whether they're here in Australia, whether they're at Korea, whether they're in Canada, whatever, they can pay attention to this. You know, you don't have to be a scientist, you don't have to be a linguist, but just notice, what do you see? Do you see multilingualism, kind of like you were saying, in the context of like, everyone can read an emergency sign, everyone can read, you know, subway station rules, things like that? Or do you see only very particular languages and therefore language communities being targeted with the signs? So there are two quite different things. And I love that it's something that once you are aware of it, you kind of can't stop seeing. Ever since I read your paper, I now do that where I just walk around and I can observe that in my own community. And you said that you don't maybe necessarily get to go collect this particular type of data that much these days, but what's next for you and your work? What other research are you working on now?
Right. Well, our team, Sungwoo Kim and Nate Minkran and myself, we're all still working on our COVID-19 linguistic landscape data. And we're this potentially could be, lifetime work. There's a lot there and a lot more that can be done still. So right now we have a draft of a paper looking at English usage on authoritative government COVID-19 signage. And what we're looking at is how English is used in at least two very different ways. It's used in one way for signs intended for a domestic Korean audience. And that's very interesting to see English used for a Korean domestic audience for non-commercial purposes. It's not marketing. It's not cool English necessarily. It's not trying to create a sense of cosmopolitanism. It's trying to reinforce good public health behavior. And we find English being used where the English text itself conveys information. The English is a meaning-making purpose, not as a symbol, but information is bound into the text. But it's also being used as a symbol or a design feature or an emblematic element. It's being used for Korean English punning. It's being used with Korean English blends where there's one message that switches between English and Korean to convey a particular message to the public, the Korean public. And so we're very interested in how English is being used for public health messaging to a domestic Korean audience. And we're also seeing English being used for a foreign, non-Korean audience of visitors or residents. And what's interesting there is very often English is being used alongside Chinese and Japanese as part of this broad multilingual communication strategy. And that kind of challenges the idea that English is this ultimate language, this lingua franca, that in fact it's being used alongside other languages as part of a broad multilingual strategy, except for particular foreign places where we do see monolingual English language signage, English-Korean bilingual signage, and sometimes multilingualism that goes beyond, English, Korean, English, Japanese, Chinese, where there's six languages or eight languages in a particular foreign place. And we do find a few examples, especially early in the pandemic, where there's kind of English that's difficult to understand. And we do want to address that too, that, and the Korean there actually was a little bit odd too. So it may be a result more of confusion early in the pandemic, and the messages were unclear, both in Korean and English. And that's something that should be addressed too. So we're looking at that. We'll continue looking at the linguistic landscape. We have a very beginning of a paper looking at Chinese signage with a heavy concern of overreading about how Chinese signage may have been overread during the COVID-19 pandemic in Korea. And we want to address how there was private sector signage that was very explicit. Basically, Chinese guests were not welcome. They were told not to enter certain restaurants or institutions. And so we want to address and bring into academic discussion the fact that these signs exist, that they were done Korean, Chinese, bilingually, that there's big issues there. That's another project that's probably further in the future. We've already published another paper. It's actually a blog. It's open access. Anyone can read it. It's quite short. And it looks at cuteness and fear in the COVID-19 linguistic landscape. And what we saw was a lot of signage, a little bit from authoritative signage, but a lot of private sector signage. So cafes and restaurants that had signs saying, please wear a mask, but they used a lot of cuteness, you know, little anime-like figures asking you, please wear a mask for me, or kind of cartoony figures with their masks saying, be like me, that type of thing. And so there was a lot of cuteness deployed in the COVID-19 linguistic landscape. And we went to an online symposium for that. And then we shared it in a blog as part of that. So cuteness and fear in the COVID-19 linguistic landscape, Google, and you can find the blog and find all the entries there. It's quite interesting. And we also in that piece talked about fear. And there was a few posters, government posters, that really strongly attempted to invoke fear. Wear your proper COVID-19 mask, or you'll end up wearing a respirator mask in the hospital. Really strong invoking of fear there. And there were other messages as well that used fear in this way. And in the conference, it was quite interesting. There was a public health expert who joined the conference, and it was quite wonderful he was there. But he was surprised. He was from South Africa. And he said, we can never use signs like this in our context. They'd be inappropriate. No one would respond to them positively. But he was very eager to learn what could be done. How can we use signs to successfully promote public health and good public health practices? And unfortunately, you know, we don't really this type of research doesn't give like an easy answer. Besides, I think an answer of saying, you know, communicating in more languages in general, not just specifically with this sort of punitive message, is probably a good productive practice. But ultimately, going deeper into that question would be an interesting long-term goal, but would require very different research methods. And so maybe that's something to think about in the future. There's a lot to be done. It would be wonderful to better understand communication through signs and other means, of course, but I'm doing more research in signs involving public health and emergencies and disasters and how those signs can be made in a way that is more productive and helpful, less damaging, less concerning in other ways, and better understand all these issues. And unfortunately, the world remains a very dangerous place. Other events will occur, not exactly the same as the COVID-19 pandemic, but conflict, war, tsunamis, earthquakes, all these things can occur, all may require changing our behavior as members of the public. And that can be shaped to some extent by these publicly displayed signs, huge posters in the subway, things on the bus, all manner of signs in an airport or any public institution, private businesses, restaurants, cafes, and more, all sharing signs that can inform the public about what to do in case of some unfortunate event, can maybe have a role in creating a better society to some extent. So we're going to keep working on this, I think, and there's a lot more that could be done.
It sounds like you said, that could be a lifetime worth of research. That's so much to draw from. And like you said, it is something that I think that we all have to take away from the COVID-19 pandemic, is to kind of look back and say, all right, what did we kind of not anticipate? What did we maybe get wrong? And how can we better prepare in the future so that we can communicate better, so that we can make sure that people from any language background can receive the information that they need in that type of a crisis? So that sounds absolutely fascinating. And on that, thank you so much for being with us today. I really appreciate it.
Oh, thank you so much for having me here. It's been an absolute delight. As I mentioned earlier, it is rare to get an opportunity to talk about, a research paper, not a big book, not a big project, but just one paper. And this is quite a paper I'm quite fond of and a research project I find quite interesting. So it has been just a delight to get a chance to talk with you. Thank you so much for all your wonderful and engaging questions. They really helped direct me and hopefully keep me on task. I really appreciate your guidance there. And yes, hopefully this encourages more members of the public to keep an eye out for signs and look for those directive signs that are made multilingual in unusual ways. And, for the researchers out there, this is an exciting area to do research. Don't be afraid. Well, I don't think researchers are afraid, but this is a productive place to do research. And the more people examining this topic, the richer the discussions become. So I'm always eager to find new people entering the field and discussing these topics.
Excellent. So everyone get out there and go look at some signs. So
yeah, great.
Thank you. And thank you to everyone for listening. If you enjoyed the show, please subscribe to our channel, leave a 5-star review on your podcast app of choice, and recommend the Language on the Move podcast and our partner, the New Books Network, to your students, colleagues, and friends. Till next time.